an opera. But the story is that after having failed to recognize any part of the sacred ceremony, Parzival, who certainly is the form of the world hero, very much in disguise, representing also the human soul very much in disguise, man standing in the presence of the great Eucharistic ceremony of life and finding that it means nothing to him. Man standing ever in the presence of the temple of the infinite, where the mystery of creation is unfolding in a great pageant ritual around him, sees nothing, understands nothing, and finds that the great mystery of growth and of God's manifestation is meaningless to him. So he leaves, assisted in his departure by the aggravated Gunamans, and finds himself wandering slowly down the mountainside until he arrives dangerously close to the evil garden of enchantment over which Klingsor rules supreme. Now, Klingsor is no fool, although his ways are not the ways of righteousness. And Klingsor was really a little smarter than Gunamans, because Klingsor, looking into the depths of his magic mirror, was able to realize that this guileless one coming down the mountain, the one who knew neither good nor evil, could be the greatest menace of all. Because there is nothing more dangerous in all the world to evil than innocence. And it was up to Klingsor to make certain that this condition of innocence was remedied as quickly as possible. Because if he could cause Parzival to lose this innocence, then the great prophecy of the Grail could not be fulfilled. In order to achieve this end, Kundry calls upon his ally, Klingsor calls upon his ally Kundry, forces her to accept his hypnotic rule, and she appears rising through the earth like some strange goddess of Greek mythology. And she is forced to do the bidding of this magician. And he selects her as the temptress for Parzival. So in due time, see Parzival arriving in the magic garden, where he is surrounded by all of the Houris and the Arabian damsels from the story of the Caliphs of Baghdad. And in the midst of them appears Kundry, who is now the servant of evil, who is now playing her role of Salome. And she uses every enticement possible to try to capture his imagination and to try to lure him into the mysteries of mortal love. She only almost captures him on one occasion, however, and that is when she rather takes a maternal attitude and begins to be sorry for him and begins to explain to him the mystery of his own origin. When this happens, Parzival is almost captured. But he is not captured by her human love as woman for man, but rather by the strange over atmosphere of her almost religious maternal interest which suddenly arises in her in spite of herself. She becomes apparently desperately sorry for the boy and wants him to really know something about himself. This peculiar complex in her disposition is climaxed, however, when Parzival, suddenly sensing or realizing perhaps the dawning awaking of consciousness in his own soul, suddenly feels this terrible pain shoot through him and feels within himself the wound of Amfortas. He suddenly realizes exactly the meaning of it all, what it signifies, everything. The great pain of the wounded Grail King strikes him. And in that moment, he awakens. He casts off the spell and escapes entirely from the mystery of the magic garden. In the meantime, Klingsor, who with his magic has been watching everything very carefully, suddenly realizes that his plot has gone awry. So he appears upon the battlement of his castle, carrying now in his hand the spear of Longinus, which he has captured from Amfortas. And in order to destroy Parzival, he now hurls the spear at him. And in the drama, this is one of the most beautiful and dramatic episodes, and it is always spoiled in the opera by having the spear run on a trolley. It is one of the saddest things that can ever happen to a great dramatic moment in an opera. But in any event, the spear misses its end because the trolley wire doesn't go in that direction. Floats in the air over the head of Parzival, if the technician is reasonably accurate, which he is not always, by the way. And Parzival grasps the spear, turns it upward, causing the point to be raised, and makes with it the sign of the cross. The moment he does so, the entire enchanted castle dissolves. Klingsor and his flower maidens and even Kundry seem to vanish together. The garden changes into a wilderness, and nothing remains but a desert such as that of some distant, unfertile area of the Sahara. Nothing remains but ruin. And carrying aloft the raised and pointed spear of Longinus, Parzival moves triumphantly offstage. The next part of the opera conveys a very interesting idea, to which we have to go back to the legends to get some of the explanation. Having raised the point of the spear, which again probably refers to the spinal fire, which he has now elevated, and has thereby escaped from the evil of Klingsor, Parzival now suddenly realizes the true meaning of virtue, has made his initiation into the mysteries, and has passed the tests and ordeals which were commonly portrayed in all similar rites in the ancient Egyptian, Greek, Roman temples. He now has an understanding, but he no longer knows where the Grail Kingdom is. And in the great legend, as it is told in the Titurel and in the other rites and later legends of the troubadours, it follows that Parzival wanders throughout the whole world. He goes everywhere as a strange, lonely person, carrying always the spear, and never being able to find the mysterious castle on the top of the mountain. He cannot get back to it. He follows path after path, but they lead only to darkness. We find him standing in one legend by the shores of the sea, looking out across the infinite mystery of the waves. He does not know where to go. He now, however, has only one thing within him, the longing to return to Montsalvat. Something is pulling him, but he does not know how to get there. And slowly we see his person change. By degrees, he takes on more and more almost the attributes and aspects of some ascetic or holy man of the East. And in order to conceal his identity, he covers his robes and garments with obscuring vestments and hides his identity, and finally is known only as a black knight, robed from head to foot in black and carrying in his hand the spear. This darkness, this obscurity, represents undoubtedly the descent of consciousness into matter, into body, and the struggle between body and soul to restore the internal faculties of apperception which have been brought into play by resisting the temptation in the Garden of Illusion. Of course, the Garden of Illusion is the material world. It is equivalent, again, we are dealing almost exactly with the legend of the prodigal son. And we are dealing again with the Gnostic poem, the Hymn of the Robe of Glory. These are always the wanderer. Here our Parzival is Ulysses, returning from the Trojan War, seeking through dangers and tests and trials and tribulations to return to his own far distant native land. And in the legends, in the great cycles of legends, which Wagner does not attempt to use, of course, Parzival has countless adventures. Countless times he thinks he has found his way. Many times he believes that success is near, only to have the grail and the mystery evaporate, disappear, vanish, until he becomes the symbol of the wanderer, the heaven seeker, and the perfect embodiment of the whole order of chivalry, which we call this order of the quest. His great quest is now for the return to the heaven world, or the overworld, the soul seeking again its heavenly estate, having taken on the dark vestment of mortality. But in the opera, we are not treated to all of these numerous episodes. We are allowed to return for that very long soliloquy by Gurnemons, which marks one of the most beautiful parts of the music, but one which is a little difficult for the amateur to fully appreciate, and that is the great Good Friday spell of Gurnemons. Here the old knight, now much older and much more venerable, is in front of his little flower-covered cottage by the side of the Grail Palace, or in the mountain woods nearby. And he, of course, recapitulates the whole story in this very long narrative song which he sings. And he tells much of the sorrows and miseries and mysteries of the way. By now, Kundry has returned more or less to her normal estate. She is no longer serving evil. She has become a very beautiful penitent now. Salome has disappeared, and in her place has come the Magdalene. And she is trying everything possible to help and to serve. She is still trying to find some remedy for Amfortas, who is still suffering in great pain and agony. And then, after a reasonable length of time, they observe a stranger coming. He is coming up the mountain, slowly, painfully, wearily. And he is dressed entirely in black, and he has a black helmet, and the visor is closed, but he is holding aloft a spear. And this one, wandering up the mountain, is not recognized either by Kundry or Gurnemons at that stage. And they wonder who is coming. And, of course, hope and fear, all the emotions that have to do with this ancient prophecy, arise within them as to whether this stranger is someone fated to bring good or ill to the company of the Grail Knights. And finally, this dark-clothed one reaches the little flat area of land in front of the house of Gurnemons. And then he suddenly drives the spear shaft down into the ground so that the point is up. And from the point of the spear shine and drop little globules of light. And immediately it is evident that this is the spear of Longinus, and that this is indeed a strange and important person who has come, because he is restoring to the knights the spear which pierced the side of Christ. Having risen from kneeling in front of the spear in prayer, the mysterious person removes his dark helmet and stands revealed as Parsifal. But it is no longer the Parsifal we saw before. In this strange interval, something seems to have happened, because the Parsifal who is revealed when the helmet is withdrawn is obviously an archetypal representation of the cosmic Christ. Parsifal has become Christ. He has become a christened being. He has become the master, or the adept prince. His long hair hangs gracefully upon his forehead, and his forked beard is trimmed exactly as in the case of the traditional pictures of the Nazarene. When he removes his dark armor, he wears not the clothing he wore before, but the seamless white robe of the Essene priest. So Parsifal stands now revealed as a parallel or a symbolic image, obviously drawn from the representations of Christ. There is a very beautiful and touching scene which follows, in which, in the form of Christ, he is accepted by Kundry. Parsifal sits down upon some rock by the side of the stage, and at his feet is a little pool. And he is barefooted, or at least his sandals are removed. And while he is there, Kundry washes his feet and dries them with her hair, exactly as is told in the Bible. And there is a very touching situation develop of the strange recognition which she has that this is no longer an ordinary person, but someone who is great of destiny and who has come to accomplish the redemption of the Grail. And then, led by Gurnemons, Parsifal, holding up the great spear of Longinus and accompanied by Kundry, climb the mountain together. The three climb the mountain to attend the great occasion of the sacrament of the Grail, the Good Friday mystery. And this time they enter also rather quietly and inoffensively. But as the knights gather and all these rituals go on, we see Parsifal and Gundry and Gunnemann's watching. No longer is he, the gander, looking for the goose, but he is simply standing patiently and quietly by, waiting. And at the time when Amfortas is supposed to elevate the host in the highest point of the ritual, Amfortas suddenly staggers. He falls partly. He breaks into tears. He realizes that he has failed. He prays for death, for liberation, anything to relieve him of the agony of attempting to perform this spiritual virtue, this wonderful mystery, when he knows this pain, this wound of worldliness or failure in his own side. And in the midst of this lamentation, Parsifal comes forward, carrying in his hand the spear. And he touches the wound of Amfortas with the spear point, and the wound is immediately healed. Then the knights, Gurnamons, the entire assembly, and Kunri, and Amfortas, bow in recognition of the spiritual destiny of Parsifal. He then takes over and completes the Eucharist, elevating the host. And at the same time, the voice of angels is heard in the music from the great dome of the temple. And the dead king, Titurel, rises in his casket to bless the occasion. Kunri, coming forward, kneels, and suddenly, with the motto of the Prince of Wales, "I serve," she falls dead at the foot of the cup. And Parsifal, as he elevates the grail cup, performs the completion of the ritual, and the mysterious symbol of the presence in the form of the dove, in the likeness of the Holy Ghost, descends and hovers over the cup. And the cup gleams and glows, and the blood of the king moves within it, and the glory of the grail is restored, and the sacred rite goes on, and Parsifal is king of the grail, fulfilling the prophecy and relieving Amfortas of his long and terrible and bitter curse. Thus we have the essential substance of the story. There are many details, but that carries the general theme. Now the story continues, of course, somewhat in the account of Lohengrin. Because Lohengrin, although he is of a different background, this part of the Parsifal story being very largely Spanish, the part we have just heard of, based upon a large legend which does not appear actually much in the opera, which is German, we have the Lohengrin, which is essentially a Belgian story and is even centered in Brabant, which is a part of the Belgian area. Lohengrin can only serve and live in the world and marry his beloved under the question or under the condition she never asks who he is or where he came from. But under a new group of temptations, the wife asks Lohengrin the fatal question. She demands to know his name and the place from whence he came. Then he declares in a magnificent piece of singing, which I think is one of the finest parts of Lohengrin, his true narrative story, concluding with the lines, "My father is Parsifal, and I am Lohengrin." And he reveals that his father is the king of the grail. Of course, after this, he has to depart, because that is the law which governs him. But the story of Lohengrin goes on and extends certain phases of the grail legend, but does not add too completely anything more to the essential theme. It's a magnificent music work dedicated to the idea of the great service that these knights are performing, and the fact that they must always operate in secret. Their true identities must never be known. That is part of the obligation by which they are bound. Now let us go back for just a moment and consider a few parallels that will give us something to do in connection with the idea of this Mantzelwart. Of course, all of you who are here, living here now, have seen our planetarium up here on this little ridge of hills. And every time I look at it, I can't help but think of Mantzelwart on the mountains of Spain. It's almost represented as that kind of a building, only much more magnificent and massive, because it was built by angels, they say, in a single night. But anyway, it was a sacred building. And this building on the top of the mountain, where the gods or the priests of the Grail, the great order of chivalry, assembled, to perform its rituals and rites. Obviously has a reference, as in the case of Meru and most of the other sacred mountains, Asgard and Olympus, to the human skull and to the mountain temple of man himself. Here we have man divided into three worlds. This division we can trace all the way right back to the writings of Aristotle, who was one of the first to notice that the human body is divisible into three great areas or openings, which are called the abdominal cavity, the thoracic cavity, and the cranial cavity. And these three each contains some very important and vital part of man. The abdominal cavity is always the underworld. And in one of the early editions of Dante, the course of Dante, and in another case, the course of Aeneas in the legend of the Aeneid, the difficult, strange, twisting underworld is represented in the form of the human intestinal tract. It's quite an amazing thing, but evidently the human body was well and early recognized as symbol of the three worlds. The human world at that time was regarded as a sort of a platter or a plate, in the midst of which, on the flat surface of which, in the midst of it was a mountain. And on the top of this mountain, which went way on up through into the sky, was the house of the gods, way above. And sometimes this mountain was in the form of a tree or an axis, as we find it among the Jains of India, and also in Japan, and in the Yggdrasil tree of the Nordic peoples. Well, the tree, of course, is the spinal cord, or spinal column, and it is also the ladder of 33 rungs, which has to do with the sacredness of the number 33, which occurs in religion, and also appears again in the 33 degrees of modern masonry. And, of course, through these three worlds, we have a concept of a complete kind of anatomical geography. The large, flat, middle land, which is called by the Nordics Midgard, or the home of men, obviously refers to the diaphragm, which sort of divides this upper world, or the middle world, rather, from the lower one. And on the top of the diaphragm is the mysterious temple of the heart, which is the center of this system. Now, the spinal column goes on and on and on up, and finally it terminates in the pons of the medulla in the brain. And here we have another very wonderful building. Aristotle says, divided from the rest of the body by an isthmus called the neck. I like that statement, an isthmus called the neck. So if you don't know what your neck is or what you are wearing your collar on, it is an isthmus. In any event, medical sciences of ancient times, and even medieval and modern times, seem to have played into this idea. Because as the spinal cord ascends into the brain, it passes two little bodies called the pyramids, which seems to be a rather interesting kind of phenomenon. And you will remember how the gods and goddesses in ancient times are supposed to have had their particular abodes on the Palatine Hill. Well, the Palatine Hill suggests a little bit the palate, and apparently was originally intended to mean that. Now, in your Christian Bible, we have references to Golgotha, the place in the skull, which is the literal meaning of the word, and Calvary, or Calvarius, a bare skull. And we know that the Egyptians and most other people recognized the brain, or particularly the skull which enclosed it, as a kind of domed building on the top of a mountain, where the gods dwelt. In the Vedic lore of India, the old and anatomical books of the Hindus, it is said that the Ganges River, which is the spinal cord, arises in the mountains at the very north of the empire and descended to water all parts of India. And of course, this sacred river rising in the brain and rising in the ancient symbols from the head of the god Shiva, it suggests very strongly the spinal cord, which occurs again as the Jordan and the Nile and practically all the sacred rivers of the world. Now, the Hindus also say that there are caves called the Caves of Ganga in the northern part of India at the very top of the mountains, and that in these caves, which are the ventricles and are also the convolutions of the brain, dwell the arhats, the rishis, the sages, and the great ones who are the teachers of mankind. And in this great dome temple also is the secret government of the world, which is supposed to be centered in the Gobina, or the sacred desert of Gobi, the temple there, or in Shambhala, or in Meru. Now, it is also curious that there should be 12 convolutions to the human brain surrounding the great central section. These have been referred to as the 12 gods of Olympus, the 12 patriarchs, the 12 prophets, and the 12 disciples. And you will remember that at the time of the Last Supper, Jesus told his disciple to go into the village and find a certain house and go into the house and ask that the upper room be made available. And that in this upper room would the Passover be held. And the upper room, of course, seemingly refers again to this upper part of the brain. Now, within the brain, there are two little organs called the pineal gland and the pituitary body. The pituitary body is located directly behind the bridge of the nose in the reverse side in a little thing called the sala turcica, or the Turkish saddle, on the inside of the sphenoid bone, directly behind the bridge of the nose, marked approximately by the place where the Indian places his caste mark, or in mythology, the third eye of the god was placed in Asiatic art. And this little gland is in the form almost of a bottle. It is a kind of cup-like body structure with a stem. And it looks very much like one of the old alchemical retorts, kind of a bottle with a twisted neck coming out of the side of it. It has an anterior and a posterior lobe, and it's quite an involved little gland, and it empties into or discharges into the great ventricular space, which lies directly behind it and which is called the third ventricle. At the same time, at the rear of the head, almost directly under the crown of the head, where the priest shaves his head, or where the tonsure referred to by St. Paul was traditionally given, there is another little gland, which is called the pineal gland, named from the pine cone, due to its shape. And this little gland has a long projecting point on it, which also faces into the third ventricle. Well, in ancient symbolism, these two glands were always associated with holy relics or sacred things. And there is every reason to assume that these, which represent polarization within the brain, the Spear of Longinus representing the positive or male pole, and the cup or the vessel representing the female or negative pole, that these two poles are represented in the human brain by these two glands, the pineal corresponding to the Spear of Longinus and the pituitary to the sangreal or holy cup. It is in this mysterious third ventricle, which corresponds to the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, that the great alchemy of the marriage of the sun and moon of the ancient Rosicrucian alchemists is said to have taken place. And it is in the electrical magnetic field accompanying this phenomena that the mysterious Star of Bethlehem is said to make its appearance. The sacredness of this area is the origin, of course, of surrounding the head with a nimbus of light, which is called a halo. And the reports that were made recently that the halo was used first on the statue of St. Peter in Rome because of the deprivations of certain birds, I do not think is quite correct. I would suggest it be passed over, because the halo is to be found in all parts of the world. And it always represents the field of spiritual magnetic activity surrounding the central ventricles of the brain. So here we have the possible concept of the complete temple of Monsovat. We have it raised upon the mountains. We have it divided from the underworld, or the world of the passions and desires. And we have it combined by means of a path which leads from the top, Monsovat, down into the valley where once stood the ancient castle of Plingsaw, the magician. We are reminded, therefore, by these two of a point that Wagner may very well have been aware of, namely that he is really setting up a bit of geography reminiscent of St. Augustine's City of God. For here we have the City of God, Monsalvat, on the top of the mountain, and its polar opposite, Babylon, the City of Death, located in the valley below. We have, therefore, the journey of the soul from death up the mountain to immortality, following the 33 steps of the ancient rituals, and ever remembering that this journey is, of course, the journey home, or the journey to light, or the journey of the quest. Because if kundri, or the spinal fire, is turned from the Muladhara chakra upward through the various members of this great system of flowers or spinal lotuses, it finally strikes the thousand petal lotus in the brain, in the midst of which is seated the palace of the gods, the golden heart, which is the emblem of Shambhala, or of the invisible hierarchy governing the world. Thus, as man is governed by the brain, by the gods dwelling in the ancient ventricular and convolutional orifices, so the world is said to have its brain upon Meru, and here Brahma and his deities administer the universal plan. In the Buddhist, it is, of course, Shambhala, the great city of the north. And in every religion and every faith, the gods ruling from their ancient mountains have governed the fates of men. And, of course, it would be quite natural where we have the Wagnerian approach without priesthood, that it would represent the pilgrimage of the truth seeker, who as Parsifal represents the truth seeker in every human being. This seeker, ascending to various degrees of unfoldment, finally takes upon himself the full attributes of the true hero of the world. And of course, in this case, Wagner is emphasizing the hero as the Christos, or the symbol of the perfected human being. This is not the Jesus of Peter, but the Christ of Paul. It is the symbol of the divine being, the Christ in you, which, if it be lifted up, will draw all things unto it. So that this is the raising of the Christ in us, and therefore the guileless fool, the innocent human being, gradually passes through these transformations, and when he returns to the castle, he returns in the full glory of his attained spiritual identity with the principle of universal salvation, so that he is then able to heal the wound of amphortis. In other words, he is able then to remedy the darkness, ignorance, or pain of mankind. He overcomes the wound of the flesh, the symbol of mortality, ignorance, and death, and becomes the master of the Grail rites and mysteries. The knights gathered around in the great circle around the high throne of the Grail therefore represent, as in the case of the church, the symbol of the human body, because the great cathedrals of Europe were all cruciform. That is, they were in the form of the human body, and in each case the high altar was placed where the head would be. This is a very common and usual practice, not only in Christian temples, but in practically all of the ancient pagan buildings. It will be found at Karnak and Luxor and Edfu, and wherever sanctuaries had been built. Thus, the story of Parsifal has several different levels of understanding associated with it. From the most physical standpoint, or the most personal standpoint, perhaps the one which Wagner wished most to emphasize, was the creation of a new way of life for man, a way essentially founded in humanism, a way in which each individual became the truth seeker and achieved his own identity with truth. The creation of a new society, a new way of life, which was very close to his Wagner's metapolitical contemplations and meditations. I do not think there is any ground for assuming that he intended Parsifal to represent the Super Teuton or anything of that nature. I think actually he represents the true Superman. Not the materialistic Superman of Nietzsche or Schopenhauer, but man as the true adept self, the true spiritually awakened being or creature, who has come into his wisdom and into his power, and who has therefore become the high priest of the mysteries of the Grail, which of course represent the mysteries of life itself. On other levels, we find this entire ritual moving gradually into almost a ceremonial of initiation into the old mystery rites. You can almost see the theologies of the Greeks, the Persians, and the Egyptians live again in this magnificent ceremonial. We also find within it many hints of alchemy, many suggestions relating to the ultimate quest for the Philosopher's Stone. For this Philosopher's Stone is Exilus, the Stone of the Grail. And also we have the art of transmutation, represented by the healing of the wound of amphortis. And we have, of course, the elixir of life or of immortality in the actual living substance moving in the Grail cup. So the whole thing can be considered a chemical experiment in which, through the union of sun, moon, and mercury, or heaven, earth, and man, as the Chinese would call it, the great mystery of redemption is achieved. We will have within it a physiological account of processes taking place within the body and of psychological processes taking place within consciousness. For all of the elements of the Grail legend can be reinterpreted in terms of the dream symbolisms and of the archaic symbolisms which man finds so archetypal in his own personal psychological research of into himself. The whole thing may be regarded as a great vision, as a great dream. And the magnificent music of it rising in the wonderful improvisation upon the theme of the great Dresden Amen goes on and on and on until it seems as though actually the music carries you into another world. It is a very exalting thing. Wagner learned the tremendous power of music and consciousness, and there is perhaps no one who has used music for the purpose of direct instruction more completely than Wagner has done so. And when I mean in complete instruction, I mean that he has taught or achieved the communication of idea by sound. It is more than a mere carrying of a mood. Through his leitmotifs and things of that nature, he has actually made music into an articulate language so that you can experience with him and you can intellectually comprehend through sound alone. So that you actually have the story plus a very important overtone. Namely, that you have the story touching on the level of vibration. And study from a standpoint of extrasensory perception of the patterns created by the Wagnerian music is really quite an important thing. It gives us and reveals to us Wagner's music as architectural. There is a massive architectural quality which seems to build into houses and temples and buildings. Instead of being magnificent floating patterns or undulating forms, as in so many of the composers, it seems as though this music puts an invisible stone upon stone and builds an exact architectural archetype until actually, before the opera is finished, Wagner has built in the energy field of music the complete pattern of the Temple of Mansalvat. He has made this building exist in the invisible world of sound. And thousands and millions of persons down through the century since it was compiled or produced have had this tremendous experience of the opera as a kind of initiation into an ancient ritual, into a wonderful story. When you leave the opera, if you have been receptive to it, you feel as though you have come from a great cathedral, almost as though you had attended High Mass at St. Peter's or something of that nature. You feel the tremendous sanctity of it, but with one difference. You feel this sanctity as a very personal thing within yourself. You do not feel it as something in which others are involved. It is all something that happens to you, which is the very principal part of the whole concept of the Grail Order, namely that all these things are known within self, and that it is indeed this Christ or Parsifal in you that is the hope of glory, that in some mysterious way you are seeing or hearing or feeling or sensing a process of alchemical transmutation taking place within your own consciousness. Of course, the mood passes. A few hours cannot hold it. But at the same time, it has been as though you visited another world or went into the temple of another faith or into some strange, mysterious world just beyond your own. And there you have a certain valid report or a certain understandable, knowable, recognizable statement of the entire concept of mysticism. You have had a kind of personal enlargement, a personal glimpse of what might be lying upon those mountains far beyond the borders of northern Spain, this invisible temple floating in the air. This mysterious order of knights represent an ever-presence of help of light, of truth, of reality. And some way, every human being becomes part of that order of knighthood. Some are the pages, some are the squires, and some are the knights. But the world becomes a great order of chivalry, centered around this temple and the ever-flowing cup of life which is enshrined there. And the knights are the servants of the ever-flowing life of space. And this ever-flowing life, the blood in the cup, is of course the same thing as the Chinese Tao. It is the symbol of universal life which sustains all things and pours from the wounds of the infinite by which the finite exists. Bimi, the German mystic, explains this, how the cleansing blood or the mystery of the life blood sustains all things, and we all have our lives because of the blood of the sun, because of the light in the air and the earth, and that all this is the blood of the Logos, the great power of life. So that all things, all creatures, become part of the orders of the quest. They become citizens of this invisible empire that extends out through all the fields of service and benevolence and is seated in the mysterious temple that is not made by the hands of men, a temple built by angels, which is a symbol of the great house of Solomon, a house eternal in the heavens. This symbolism is all very rich and very mysterious. Of course, you bring to it what you have. It means what it means to you, primarily. But it also, like all good instruction, like a well-fashioned Tibetan or Chinese or Japanese mandala, it calls out of you all that it can. It becomes an outer symbol or picture of an inner conviction. And if you can move out to meet it, it becomes a tremendously moving, vital, and real thing. I think that any individual who has the opportunity to see the opera should do so, and perhaps many times. Because in Wagner, you have to see Tristan anywhere from 40 to 50 times before you even really hear it. And you probably will have to see or hear Parsifal as often as is possible in the average person's lifetime, because it is not awfully frequent, but we are given the opportunity. But we must hear it and see it many times, because it is overwritten in so many mysterious ways. Even a careful study of the score will not convey all of the overtones. You always learn something else. You always observe, notice some new or strange combination of tones, and you are being told a story. The story meet and mingle like an experiment in chemistry. And each new mingling has an important part to play in the total picture. So the more often you see it, the better you will sense its meaning. And also, the more completely you will be able to identify its ritualism and symbolism with your own studies. Because each time, something new will be seen. I like to think of the Grail Cycle, as Wagner gives it to us, as his contribution, as his New Testament, in the great sacred writing which he compounded out of the two great descents, the Volsung and the Sanaboden. And these two descents, the Old and New Testament, the Old and New Dispensation, show first of how the world of human ambition and even of divine will, the great world of the law, slowly fell into space. And out of that old world grew the new world, the world of the New Dispensation, the world that was not governed by law, but by love. And that this love is the perfect law. And that there is nothing in law which is not perfected in love. And that law and love are really the same thing. Law is love seen from the outside. And love is law and actually seen from the inside. Thus, actually, the law and the prophets are not in conflict. The man who breaks the law is aware of the law. The man who does not break the law beholds the law as love. Thus, through obedience, law disappears in love. And that which was originally the struggle for existence becomes the glorious unfoldment of redemption. All of this, it seems, is contained in this wonderful double cycle. And perhaps for that reason, we are strangely and profoundly indebted to the genius of Richard Wagner. I think that is our subject for this evening.